Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie dropped out of the Republican presidential race, and he took a jab at Wyoming Senator John Barrasso on the way.
People like Senator John Barrasso stand up and endorse Donald Trump. They know better.
And a new book takes a look at some history in our state that really hasn't been told before.
As incredible and unbelievable as it sounds, it's all 100% true.
Gillette wrapped up what will become a yearly competition of creativity and business innovation in Northeast Wyoming.
You know, they would have significant numbers of people that they employ, and it's all based out of Wyoming.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Hello, listeners. This is Megan Feary, and our latest episode of Human Nature is a great big animal rescue, one of the biggest in U.S. history, and Gail Woodsum was there.
And I picked up the phone, and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane, because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Hey there, this is Kelly Trujillo. Join me Saturday mornings for Buffalo Grass, 11 to 1 on listener-supported Wyoming Public Radio. You'll hear the best in bluegrass music, old and new, plus Americana, folk, Western, and even a little bit of Celtic. That's Buffalo Grass, Saturdays at 11 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Ahead of Iowa's first in the nation GOP caucuses on Monday, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie dropped out of the contest, but not before taking a jab at Wyoming senior Senator John Barrasso and other Republicans who he calls cowards. Wyoming Public Radio correspondent Matt Laszlo joins us from Washington to discuss.
Thanks for having me.
So earlier this week, Wyoming Senator John Barrasso became the highest ranking member of Senate Republican leadership to endorse former President Donald Trump. And it seems that that didn't sit well with former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who accused Barrasso, House Majority Whip Tom Emmer, and other Republicans of cowardice and hypocrisy for backing Trump.
And you just look at what's happening just in the last few days. Good people who got into politics, I believe, for the right reasons. People like Senator John Barrasso, people like Congressman Tom Emmer, stand up and endorse Donald Trump. They know better. I know they know better.
How's Barrasso reacting to all of this?
Well, in typical Barrasso fashion, you know, he's kind of laughing it off, which his colleagues aren't. I'm doing a piece for Raw Story where I actually interviewed 15 Republican senators about this very strange barb, because you usually don't hear Republican officials call out other Republican officials. And so when we asked his colleagues about it, they're kind of offended on his behalf. But Senator Barrasso himself says he didn't listen to this speech and he's not going to lower himself to Christie's level. Last night,
I heard that he had. Yeah. I didn't actually hear him. I wish him well. I wish him well.
And now, if you remember, Barrasso's not just Wyoming's senior senator. He took the gentlemanly route there in part because he's the third highest ranking Republican leadership here in the Senate. And so he's got to put on a good face for the party, because when he was attacked, he wasn't just attacked as Wyoming senator. He was attacked as senior Republican official.
So you mentioned you spoke to other Republicans. Did you speak to any of Wyoming representatives?
Yeah, I caught up with Wyoming's junior senator, Cynthia Lummis, and she stood out there and had Barrasso's back. Few to none heard Christie's speech, but when I was informing these Republicans of it, many, like Lummis, stood up for Barrasso.
Yeah, I think that's personally offensive. Just because Chris Christie is infected with Trump derangement syndrome, doesn't mean that someone who endorses Trump for president is somehow off the farm.
And again, Lummis isn't alone. If anything, in today's newly revamped GOP, Christie is the lonely one.
So why take the shot on the way out?
It's interesting that some Republicans, like Senator Todd Young of Indiana, said they respected Christie for, well, being Chris Christie. You know, he's a New Jersey guy. He's in your face. He built his career on that as the governor of the Garden State. And that's actually what he brought or tried to bring to the Republican primary. It seems Republican voters rejected that, but Chris Christie did stay on brand. But other Republicans aren't loving the Jersey boy coming out in Christie, especially on this national stage, as North Carolina Republican Senator Ted Budd noted.
What's New Jersey got to do with Wyoming?
That's likely a question many listeners are asking themselves. What's New Jersey got to do with Wyoming? But it highlights Barrasso's kind of quiet climb up the ranks of GOP leadership. With power comes more attacks, as the Cheney family knows.
And as you mentioned earlier, Barrasso's pretty high up there in GOP leadership. What's his future looking like?
Well, it's interesting. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, he's up there in years. He's now 81. And so Barrasso's name has been batted about as a potential replacement for Senator McConnell. There's two other senators who are kind of more naturally positioned to take over for McConnell. One is South Dakota Republican John Thune. The other is Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn. But this is politics, and you never know. And so Barrasso's kind of been quietly building relationships with his fellow Republicans, helping them from his perch as Republican conference chair. Really go out there and fight in this hyperpartisan Washington and this hyperpartisan political environment. And so we'll see as he's quietly laying that groundwork, helping others with fundraising because he's got a fairly safe seat there in Wyoming. We'll see. He seems like he definitely wants to climb the leadership ladder.
Great. Well, Wyoming Public Radio's Washington correspondent, Matt Laszlo, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Circling back to politics in the Mountain West, libraries are becoming a battleground for culture wars with children at the center. That includes here in Wyoming, where some residents want libraries to restrict access to books. Aspen Public Radio's Caroline Yanez reports on one controversy for the Mountain West News Bureau.
At the Glenwood Springs Branch Library, a couple dozen kids and adults are using kid-friendly plastic needles, thick embroidery thread, and safety scissors to assemble little felt-stuffed dinosaurs from kits. In short, it's a typical Wednesday afternoon with the Spark program, designed to spark kids' imaginations in a fun, safe, social environment. 7-year-old Graham Aguirre and his mom Ashley are working on a mini T-Rex plush. Ashley is holding the felt pieces together while Graham goes to town with the needle.
The unders are under.
No.
Right. Maybe it's under over instead of over under.
It's either one.
Graham is homeschooled, and the Spark program helps fill in some of the gaps. And Ashley says the library is a great place for Graham to have fun and express his creativity.
They've had a great program, and then, you know, he loves to pick out books and everything after. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
As Graham and other kids craft, adult patrons read, work on computers, or simply warm up by the library's fireplace. In this peaceful setting in western Colorado, it's tough to imagine that this and other county libraries have served as the battleground for a fierce culture war for months. Last summer, a nearby resident started a petition to prevent children from accessing a pair of Japanese manga graphic novels. They carry age warnings and are shelved in the adult section. At a September library board meeting, the woman read from the petition. She wanted the books kept under lock and key, and for librarians to CID before allowing them to be checked out.
If these requirements are not met, then we request all materials of the aforementioned warning be removed from the library inventory.
After she challenged these books, library staff read them all the way through and determined they were shelved correctly in the adult section. They also declined to keep the books under lock and key or have librarians check ID. Jamie LaRue is the executive director of the library district.
There is no library in the United States that does that. And in fact, no child has been reading these.
LaRue hosted a public forum in October, where the vast majority of attendees were against restricting access to books. During his presentation, he said the library can't restrict access to these materials anyways.
Minors also have First Amendment rights.
One critic wrote a letter in a local newspaper calling on librarians to be arrested for, quote, knowingly transferring or attempting to transfer obscene matter to minors. Emily Drabinski is the president of the American Library Association. She says this kind of language is demoralizing for library professionals, and it misses the point of what public libraries are doing for children.
So if you want your children to read during the summer and to have access to all kinds of reading materials of interest, if you care about early childhood literacy, then your library is the place that's making that possible.
Here in rural Garfield County, Red Milbury is one of the people doing that work.
Before you finish sewing, you need to leave a big enough gap to put the stuffing in, and then we'll finish the sewing, okay?
Milbury is the youth services coordinator at the Glenwood Springs branch.
Librarians are set up in such a unique way because we have the ability to design our lessons and what we want to provide to the community based on the community's needs.
To address those many needs, Garfield County libraries offer broadband internet access, help applying for jobs, free health screenings through community partners, and conversation groups for people to practice both their English and Spanish. And they're among the 30% of public libraries nationwide that offer some kind of food aid. Here's Milbury again.
Your wealth means nothing here. We provide services to all. And I think that's the best thing about libraries is it's the great equalizer. Everybody has the same footing here.
And it's this kind of critical work that keeps library staff fighting for their communities. Milbury says they're learning to deal with bitter objections to some books and programming, and they know it won't be going away anytime soon. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caroline Yanez.
This story was produced with help from the Public Media Journalists Association Editor Corps. It's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. Up next, we check in with a young Northern Arapaho citizen who attended COP28 last month. This is Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at ingel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Big Wind Carpenter, a Two-Spirit member of the Northern Arapaho tribe, attended the United Nations Climate Conference in Dubai in December, also known as COP28. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman spoke with Carpenter a few days after they got back from the conference. She started off asking what the major takeaways were.
Weather-wise, it's really warm over there. It's about 90 degrees, 85 degrees, which is very different from the winter I'm used to. So I'm glad to be back where there's snow. The conference was long. It was a two-week conference. And so I think two big wins that people seen are kind of around the Loss and Damage Fund, which essentially is a fund that gives to countries from the Global South resources in times of catastrophe. And then really the last one kind of came a few days ago where there's kind of been this mention of fossil fuels inside it being the cause. Essentially, the Conference on Climate Change has kind of shied away from those things. But there was very strong language in this last agreement that mentions the transition away from fossil fuels. And so people are kind of like holding those two winds at this moment.
I know you are part of the International Indigenous Youth Forum on Climate Change and spent some time speaking at the conference. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you talked about and the things that you are passionate about elevating on this super international stage.
So I was a part of a Wisdom Keepers delegation. So over the first couple of days, was able to be a part of some formal negotiation proceedings dealing with like knowledge holders, different tribes. We have traditional ecological knowledge and technologies that just interact with the land in different ways. And so that was really important, especially as a lot of these plans are starting to be made, that they include not only us as like politics of recognition, like just in the preambles and like us just like speaking as like panels and site events, but that we're actually involved in the negotiations process. The IPCC put out this report where 80% of the world's biodiversity is protected by indigenous people, while we make up less than 5% of the human population. Ensuring that indigenous people are involved is like one of my core things of why I do what I do. And I think for us, when we're talking about biodiversity and it being around tribal lands, surrounded by tribal lands, the Wind River Reservation is no different. Our territory is home to various minerals and fuels, but it's also surrounded by public lands. My advocacy for this landscape has kind of taken my work to the international stage. In my lifetime, I'm going to witness seeing our glaciers cease to exist. We have, you know, less than 30 years. And so it's really interesting to bring some of these local stories to the international stage, because oftentimes we can be spouting facts and they go one ear and out the other. But once you can start to like pull on some people's heartstrings, they start to make better decisions, it seems like.
I know at the UN conference, they reached a deal trying to keep the world in line with limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Do you think that goal is possible? And if so, what do you think needs to happen or change to make that happen?
You know, it's really interesting. This is the first year where actually a fossil fuel CEO was the COP28 president. And so we had industry in the driver's seat of the climate negotiations. Historically, fossil fuel lobbyists have showed up in mass. That has been like a trend. But the number of fossil fuel lobbyists allowed into the conference this year essentially went up 300% from last year. And one of the big asks this year was to get the fossil fuel phase out, quote unquote, fossil fuel phase out. And because of this like overwhelming support of the fossil fuel people like at the negotiations, like that language was not added intentionally. The Secretary General of OPEC actually released a letter telling countries and supports to not listen to any phase out language and instead push for transitioning language intentionally. And so even though we're looking at something like as a victory of this, you know, new transitioning away from fossil fuels, it's actually intentionally coming from the fossil fuel industry. And that is kind of disheartening, where you can see this like clear, distinct line through who's running these negotiations, who has the most representation, and essentially the industry telling them what to say, and then they say it.
How does that influence maybe how you see conversations around energy transitions in Wyoming and what you think that might look like in the future?
It's interesting because I'm Northern Arapaho, and so I come from an oil and gas tribe. Oil is definitely, and gas and energy production has been a legacy institution in this state for a long time. And so you have multi-generational people who've worked on the rigs, multi-generational coal miners. And for a long time, it has been essentially the saying when they say it's oil and gas is our bread and butter. So I'm not denying that. And also on the reservation, we have been, our lives have changed because of oil and gas. When we started profiting from it, I don't think that my leaders knew the impacts that it would have on the environment, the impacts that it would have on our health, the impacts that it would have later in the climate. I don't think that they knew any of those things when they decided to make those decisions over 100 years ago. But now we're in a precipice in time where our leaders do know that these minerals that we're deciding to use actually have detriment to our health, to the environment, and therefore the climate. And so we have an obligation to start shifting how we handle things for the future generations. For a long time, because our education system is funded by the fossil fuel industry, a lot of people couldn't talk about climate. The first climate summit that happened in the state was on the Wind River Reservation, held at the Wind River College. A couple years later, the first statewide conference happened at a border town here in Lander. So now we're starting to be able to educate people on these situations. And you can't talk about climate if you're not going to talk about what actually causes these situations. And so first, as a state, need to get on the same education, understanding that this is how it was, but now we know the impacts and what are we going to do about it so that we can help future generations and the safety of our planet.
I've been talking with Big Wind Carpenter, a Two-Spirit Northern Arapaho activist who recently attended this year's United Nations Climate Conference in Dubai. Big Wind, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
Oh, thank you.
Wolves now have a larger territory in our region. Just across Wyoming's border, Colorado has started releasing this species along the western slope, part of a voter-approved reintroduction plan. But some area residents are worried about the impact. KUNC's Scott Franz reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
The guard dogs on Joe Stanko's ranch in northwest Colorado sprint down a dirt road at the first sniff of a stranger. I haven't even stepped out of Stanko's car before one of them jumps inside to investigate.
Hey, get out of my car!
Get out of the car.
Sit. No. No.
Gizmo, the herding dog, has left muddy paw prints all over the leather seats.
He just jumped right in.
Oh yeah, she does. She thinks all vehicles are hers.
I step outside and another dog is staring up at me.
Yeah, I know.
This is Kaiba, and she scares off coyotes, the four-legged canines that presently threaten livestock. After a few seconds and dozens of sniffs, Kaiba confirms I'm not a coyote and returns to check on the livestock. These dogs are about to become even more critical for the Stankos and the dozens of hens, pigs, and cows who live on this 2,000-acre ranch just west of Steamboat Springs. Colorado Parks and Wildlife is releasing the pack of wolves from Oregon, as close as 100 miles away from here. And this voter-mandated reintroduction has been making the Stankos and other livestock producers anxious.
I don't think that I know of any ranchers that are anticipating the reintroduction of wolves like they're anticipating Christmas.
Here in Rout County, 60% of voters opposed bringing wolves back, while some ranchers spent the last 4 years at the State House lobbying to delay or block this month's release day, the Stankos quickly decided to look forward. They went dog shopping.
She's only two. She's the same age as Nova.
Enter Samson. He's an 11-week-old Turkish Boz that will soon weigh 200 pounds. Even his ears have been cropped to give a wolf one less thing to grab onto.
He's pretty fearless, which is, I'm kind of surprised for a puppy. That could be a good thing or a bad thing.
Jan Stanko is Joe's daughter-in-law, and she's in charge of shoring up the wolf defense system on the ranch, which has been in the family for more than a century. She says Samson's training is going well, and the idea is to have the bigger dogs deter any wolf from even coming onto the property.
they're definitely not the answer to everything, because really it takes about 2 years for them to get big enough to be a deterrent against a predator.
The sun is starting to set, and Joe Stanko takes me in an ATV to a large field where her cows are ready for dinner. The herd quickly surrounds us, expecting treats.
We forgot to bring cookies. Go away, you guys.
Instead, they settle for licking my microphone.
No cookies.
This is what's at stake, right?
Like right. There's, literally, are you being funny?
I did not mean to. But yeah, I mean, what?
Yeah, this is what's at stake. These are the animals that, if they're attacked by wolves, it's.
Stanko says the ranch runs on tight financial margins, and even though Colorado will pay up to $15,000 for each cow killed by a wolf, it doesn't replace everything.
You can't just go out and buy another cow that can survive and actually gain weight or grow babies on the same property. There's genetics and temperament.
People to the south who live even closer to the wolf drop zone have other concerns.
This is just another predator now. So another thing to watch out for with children and small animals.
Lisa Langer is the tourism director for the city of Glenwood Springs. It's a mountain town known for its rejuvenating hot springs. It's also right next to one place the state says it might release the first pack of wolves. Could that benefit a town that relies on tourism?
No, I don't think the wolf introduction will be a boon to tourism. I think that it may be a detriment in some ways.
But almost every Colorado mountain town has wildlife viewing in their marketing ads. Their shops are full of t-shirts with bears and moose on them. How could wolves not be a tourism boon?
They're talking about a herd of elk at a distance, the bighorn sheep on the mountainside. I mean, those are all things that are beautiful to view at a distance. I think it's going to be harder to see where the wolves are.
Langer says wolves might actually scare some tourists, so she says she won't put them on marketing brochures. On the other side of Colorado's Continental Divide, Rob Edward isn't feeling anxious about wolves. The Lafayette resident has been leading efforts for the last quarter century to bring them back here, and he's already planning a trip to try and find one.
It's a manifestation of my life's work. And I feel extremely fortunate to have spent my life doing something that culminates in the world being a better place.
When the wolves take their first steps out of their cages this month, Edward has a good idea of what they'll do next. Studies of wolves released in Yellowstone showed they moved an average of 50 miles in a matter of months.
They're going to try to get away from all the hubbub as quickly as possible. Hopefully they will keep tabs on each other and, you know, travel together and ultimately mate, and maybe even by this spring we could have pups on the ground.
But Edward has studied wolf behavior long enough to know that not everyone will be thrilled with what happens next.
There's going to be livestock depredation. There's going to be some folks who get ticked off because they just don't want it to happen.
Back on the Stanko Ranch near Steamboat Springs, Joe Stanko is continuing her preparations. She's considering purchasing trail cameras. She's also coming to terms with the uncertainty of it all.
Wolves are going to do what wolves are going to do.
But the Stankos are making allies. They're building relationships with the people like Rob Edward, who fought to bring the predators back here. Last year, the Stankos invited 36 wolf advocates to their ranch to mingle at an informal summit.
We're both highly involved in environmental issues. And we don't want what's best for the environment. We just have had a disagreement on how to do it. In fact, I think we're doing it better than the Democrats and the Republicans in the legislature. You know?
Stanko says the relationships she's building with wolf advocates will help both sides come together if any issues emerge in the coming months. She's also got a bigger dog pack now, keeping tabs on the ranch. I'm Scott Franz in Rout County, Colorado.
Gillette has a new startup competition. We take a deeper look, coming up on Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West. Ariel's family and neighbors start rebuilding after the Marshall Fire destroys their homes. But new green building codes are making it super expensive.
You're just propping up the people who can afford this, and it's really elitist. You know, it's saying if you can't afford any of this, you're not going to live here.
A Desirable Neighborhood. It's part four of our series, The Burn Scar. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by the Argosy Foundation.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we cut through the distracting clutter in the week's news and get to what really matters.
It's sweet, but can we talk about the nipple rings?
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we take the shirt off the news and see what's under there every week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 4 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Let's stick with the subject of wildlife. Environmental changes are affecting birds and their migration patterns. Birds benefit from the changing seasons, but with hotter summers and colder winters, along with disappearing habitats, some species are struggling to keep up. Boise State Public Radio's Katie Kloppenberg reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
The McGillivray's warbler is a small bird that spends most of its time lurking in dense underbrush. With a bright yellow belly and a gray head, the bird has its breeding grounds in most of Idaho, the Pacific Northwest, and stretching up into Canada. And in early fall, the warbler begins making its way down to Mexico and parts of Central America.
They should be fueling up, getting fatter and fatter to kind of fuel that gas tank.
That's Heidi Ware Carlisle, the education director at the Intermountain Bird Observatory in Boise. She was studying how road noise was impacting this and other birds.
For example, McGillivray's warblers didn't change in number whether we were playing a bunch of road noise or whether it was beautiful, pristine quiet. But when they were there in the road noise, they did terribly on migration.
From road noise to habitat loss to light pollution, there are a lot of reasons why bird migration is being affected by humans. But right now, the data isn't clear. But what is clear is that birds are migrating earlier.
So you see a bigger spread in terms of the timing of leaving the breeding grounds and going back to the wintering grounds. And there's some variation in that around the world. So you see birds advancing the timing of their migration by, you know, 2 or 3 days every decade.
That's Brian Weeks, an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. Scientists aren't seeing a huge shift in migration from climate change yet, but the warning signs are there.
Even as the world warms a little bit, you don't see any sort of major switches from migratory behavior to non-migratory behavior. They're not even close to being able to overwinter in Boise. They have to make these migrations or they'll all die over the winter.
When thinking about conservation, some species are going to do all right. But with species already impacted by diminishing habitats, they are going to face more challenges.
Whether or not species are going to be able to continue to advance the timing of their migration while also dealing with the fact that they're shrinking is a really open question that we just can't answer.
However, birds are slowly adapting to climate change. Besides migrating earlier and shifting habitats, we're seeing longer wingspans and other physiological changes. But will their adaptations be enough? And what does that mean for humans?
You should think about birds as, you know, the canaries in the coal mine. They're reflecting our general impact on natural systems. And they're declining. And they're declining because we are reducing the extent and quality of natural habitats.
But at some point, birds will run out of spaces to move. Chris McClure with the Peregrine Fund in Boise says birds will be driven more and more to the Earth's poles, but birds already there can't go anywhere.
They're already at the end of the Earth, basically. So they will, some species we have, you know, quantitatively shown will run out of habitat or at least have less habitat.
So you're wondering, well, this is all happening, but what can I do? For noise pollution, you pick bikes over cars, plant more trees as noise buffers, and maintain your vehicle if you must drive. Education Director Ware Carlisle again.
People don't like noise pollution either, so it's a little bit of an easier sell, I think. Be like, hey, in these protected areas, can we do something? It's going to benefit wildlife and it's going to benefit, you know, human enjoyment.
Brian Weeks of the University of Michigan says controlling light pollution can go a long way.
If you're looking for actions, the things that can be done are lights out programs in big urban areas, There needs to be some sort of critical mass of light, apparently, to attract birds into these buildings.
And Chris McClure says civic engagement can also help.
I'm not going to say who to vote for or anything, but if you care about conservation, at least vote for science-based candidates that respect the process of science and are willing to follow the facts.
As the world warms and our habitat transforms, birds can show us how making it a better place for them will make it a better place for us. Katie Kloppenberg, Boise State Public Radio News.
A group of state investors and business leaders known as Impact 307 are trying to spur innovation in Wyoming. And a brand new competition that took place in Gillette is doing just that. The first annual Energy Capital Startup Challenge chose three uniquely Wyoming ideas for their finalists. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger speaks with Scott Rendell, the head of the Energy Capital Startup.
Before we jump into the competition, let's talk a little bit about the history of this. Did this come out of a want for Wyoming to kind of open up for business? Are they trying to get more homegrown businesses here? Or was it just kind of a way for potential investors to see who is creatively operating the free market here?
So Impact 307 has been running startup challenges for quite a few years now. And the idea is to find people that may be contemplating a new business or contemplating an idea, but really haven't acted on the idea. The competition actually serves as a nice spark for getting them kind of engaged to pursuing something. And so some grant funding that has come up in the last 3 years, through that grant, we have been able to expand our startup challenge footprint to about 11 different communities across the state. Most recently, the startup challenge that we had last week in Gillette, which was called the Energy Capital Startup Challenge because it encompassed Campbell County as well as a lot of the rural counties to the east.
What do you see as a long-term goal with each of these passing competitions? Is to see one of these startup ideas flourish into a large business that's now based in, or a corporation now based in Wyoming, or just to get people off the ground and then what happens from there happens?
We're hoping to maximize the number of startup entrepreneurs that are successful in starting and growing a business. And so some of those might just be a handful of people that they would employ. It might be, you know, four or five people. But that's four or five jobs that didn't exist prior to our program. All the way up to if we have someone that goes through our startup challenge process, continues to work on their plan, attracts the attention of venture capitalists or, you know, angel investors, gets additional funding, we would hope that we would have a few home runs out there that would, you know, they would have significant numbers of people that they employ, and it's all based out of Wyoming. That would be great.
And let's talk about some of those potential products and services, too. Can you talk about the three winners from the competition?
The three winners for Gillette were wind turbine blade recycling. So we have a father and son combination in conjunction or in partnership with the Western Research Institute, and they are doing research into the feasibility of producing usable material and products out of recycled wind turbine blades. So they are driving a lot of the technology. The group in Gillette would actually take basically shredded blade material and be able to, through manufacturing processes, be able to produce usable materials out of that recycled content. And so that's a very intriguing idea. It's very early stage, but they obviously, with the number of turbines that are going up across the country, it's going to be a pretty significant industry to get into. So that's one of the winners of our Energy Capital Challenge. Baldacci Guitars was another winner. So this is an individual, Connor Baldacci, that has an existing custom guitar manufacturing business, been very passionate about that. He's got a really nice start. He made a really nice presentation. I think he's got a great future and, you know, hopefully making that a really nice business that would be based out of Gillette. And then the final winner was a company called Ag Innovations. And this is a ranching couple, and they had developed what they call a water rippler that keeps a ripple of water on the surface of a stock tank that will hopefully
keep a small portion of the tank open for stock to come and get water in the wintertime.
Let's say someone came to you with a device that says, I'm going to, you know, give you the most return in a certain industry, but the device is going to do it by replacing, like, the worker, automation, essentially. Does that go against the purpose of such a competition? Because a lot of times you mentioned, you know, we're trying to maximize employment here as well. So I'm just curious if automation as a development idea contradicts the purpose of some of the startup challenges.
So I would say that, yeah, that could happen, but a lot of times those types of businesses that produce huge breakthroughs in efficiency and in automation have their own, you know, personnel and staff that they need to hire to be able to develop and proliferate what they've done. So I would say it's possible, but a lot of times it still ends up being a significant operation that, you know, contributes to the overall nation economy, which is great.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger interviewing Scott Rendell of Impact 307 and the Gillette Energy Capital Startup Challenge. Stay tuned for a future interview with one of the winners of the group, Cameron and Jess Anderson, a father-son duo creating the next generation of recyclable tech through reimagining old wind blade turbines. Up next on Open Spaces, some little-known history about eastern Wyoming.
Hi, it's Daryl Brogdon here with the Underground Martini Bunker, home of the Retro Cocktail Hour. I hope you'll join us every week for classic tiki tunes, TV crime, jazz, swinging soundtracks, and more. You're the designated driver on the Highway of Cool at the Retro Cocktail Hour. Saturday night at 6 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Neuroscientist Wendy Suzuki basically lived at her lab.
I just felt really, really bad.
So she started working out, which improved more than just her muscles.
My focus was working better, and that made me say, what's going on here?
Wendy's discovery has kept her active ever since. New ideas to help you keep your resolutions. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Gadalska. For this next story, we're going to take a look back in time to 3 days in July in 1864. And it's not the Civil War, rather the Platte River Raids, where settlers in covered wagons coming to the Medicine Bow Forest were met on the trail by the Northern Plains Indians. Things quickly escalated and the Union cavalry was called in. Many people died. And it was pretty tragic all the way around. It's actually a piece of history that hasn't really been well documented for the present day until now. Historian Janelle Maloney wrote the book Immigrant Tales of the Platte River Raids and did a lot of the research to collaborate the stories and timeline. Maloney spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan.
Well, Janelle, thank you so much for joining us. And so give us a little bit of a summary about the raids.
Right. So the Platte River Raids are a very well-coordinated ambush on a stretch of trail about 80 miles between Fort Laramie and Deer Creek Garrison, which is in present-day Glen Rock. And the Northern Plains Indians, loosely Cheyenne, Northern Arapaho, and Sioux, came down what was not yet Bozeman Trail, and they, I believe, were intending to disarm and take horses from the immigrants to stop travel on the Bozeman Trail, to say, hey, you know, stay on your designated trail, right? That's protected by the treaty, that is all agreed upon, you know, everyone stay in your zone. So, unfortunately, you know, the immigrants responded. They were scared, they fought back, guns were fired, everything escalated. For 3 days, it actually blows up into a huge problem that the Union now has to do something about, and yet they're strained. And so the way that they react is,
so strong, so severe, egregious crimes against humanity, it just gets way out of control, and it sends shockwaves through the Great Plains, and the tribal families feel the effects as far south as down in Colorado. This is a major event that leads up to the Sand Creek massacres in Colorado, and yet it's been overlooked for 200 years.
From what I understand, other than your work, this book, there isn't a lot of information out there about this rich part of American history. Why do you think that is?
I think they've been looked at in the past as isolated cases. One single individual family getting attacked is considered a valid attack, but another family that just heard about the attacks was considered a completely separate, irrelevant story. So I started to expand the search, and now I have these 68 eyewitness accounts. And at that point, it's like, there's no questioning this. This happened.
Now, Janelle, you mention in the preface of your book that there is one side of the Platte River raid story that's not as well represented, and that's from the Northern Plains Indians. Is that a side of the story that is documented or that could in the future be uncovered?
It is documented and it can be uncovered. However, I'm not the right person to tell that story. And part of my process in putting the tales together is that I actually tried to remove myself from the narrative as much as possible to leave just the voices of the people who were there and saw it for themselves. And included in that is a collection of oral histories that were recorded by Alfred Burton Welch, who is the son of John Grass. They'll use his, I guess, American name, John Grass, Chief John Grass, and the grandson of Chief Bill Grass. Their voices are just one tiny sliver of the perspective from the Northern Plains Indians. But it was really important that I included them because there's such a strong good-bad element where the immigrants have bias. The union has very strong bias as well. And so it was important just to show a glimpse of, wait a second, let's hear from someone else on the other side who was there, who lived through it, and let them speak up for themselves. And I wanted to be careful not to add additional commentary to that or put my own perspectives in that. So again, I don't consider myself the right person to speak on anyone's behalf of any of those tribes. And I feel like it's time. It's time for someone to take up that mantle and compose a rebuttal, compose the other half of this story.
So it sounds like definitely there's work to be done. There's more to the story that could come eventually. Janelle, anything else you want to share or to entice Wyoming listeners as to why they should read the book?
It is a classic covered wagon story. So for the folks who like that travel, adventure, Wild West, they've got poison water holes and all those fun things. But it's also a really interesting look at military history from both the military's own reports and journals and diaries, but also the immigrants and how they see the military as very dysfunctional. And there's also this big coming-of-age moment for the famous Wild West lawman, Wyatt Earp. He's a teenager on the trail, but he is given the responsibility of protecting his family during not one, but two attacks on his company. So I think you'll just have a great time going through it, knowing that as incredible and unbelievable as it sounds, it's all 100% true.
We've been speaking with Janelle Maloney, author of the new book, Emigrant Tales of the Platte River Raids. The book is out and available online.
To hear a reenactment of these raids, check out our series Mending the Hoop on the Modern West podcast at wyomingpublicmedia.org. 2 summers ago, the nonprofit StoryCorps hosted an oral history project here in Wyoming, in which veterans and their families recorded honest and personal stories about their military experience. We're grateful and excited to share those conversations with our listeners as a monthly series on Open Spaces. In today's story, we meet a husband and wife who reflect on their separate journeys serving in the Air Force and how they've supported one another along the way.
Hello, my name is Anna Ayers. I'm 49 years old.
Hello, my name is Silvio Ayers. I'm 60.
What were your reasons behind joining the military?
My father was a truck driver, and I was 18, and we were in Rhode Island. And he told me, "You're 18 now, son. You got to start thinking about making a living." And he said, "When we get home, you want to, you know, I'll buy you a truck and you can drive trucks." In that moment, my whole life flashed in front of me, and I'm like, there's no way in hell I'm driving a truck for the rest of my life. So we got back from Rhode Island. I went to sleep. I got up, went down to the recruiter. Next thing I know, I was off to basic training. So you deployed once. I know you did.
I deployed in 1997 to Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia. As a female in Saudi Arabia, I was not allowed to leave the installation once I arrived. And I was there for 6 months.
During that deployment, we were dating, and I just happened to get orders there with her. So I got there a little bit before her, and I left a little bit before her. But it was my favorite deployment.
We met in City Limits. It was a bar in Clovis, New Mexico. It was my last active duty station, Cannon Air Force Base. And I had walked into this country bar with my friend, and she introduced me to my husband.
So, like she said, she was introduced to me, and we were talking, and I looked at her and I said, "I know you." And she's like, "Yeah, whatever." She turned around and walked away. And she had this jacket on, and it said Southern Conspiracy, Korea. And I said, "Hey, 4th of July, Osan Air Base, flatbed trailer, you were singing backup vocals in a country western band in the transportation yard." And she stopped dead in her tracks and turned around and looked at me. And she goes, "That was over 2 years ago." And I said, "I'll never forget a pretty face."
True story.
True story.
So you retired from the military. Tell me a little bit about the events that led up to your retirement.
I was the first sergeant at headquarters NATO. I had about 500 troops, and I'd been there for 4 years, and it was just, I was going to work and it wasn't getting fun anymore. And I'm like, I don't want to look back on my career and have any regrets. I wanted the military to be part of my life. I didn't want it to be my life.
Yeah, I had gotten out of the Air Force, right? Active duty right before we got married. And I found that I missed being in the Air Force. I found that I missed the camaraderie. I also missed the rules and regulations. I knew what I had to do, when I had to do it, how I had to do it. So after 9/11 happened, he retired. And I asked him, I said, "What do you think about me going in the reserves?" Or, at the time it was the reserves. He says, "Yeah, do it. Do what you want." His career, ended and mine started over. So, and we've been doing that ever since.
I remember I was, for lack of a better term, a civilian military policeman on the guard base where she was at. And I came home from duty one night and she's like, "Hey, you want to move to Wyoming?" And I'm like, "What?" She goes, I just got a full-time position offer at Wyoming." And I'm like, "Sure, let's go." One of the things when my wife said she was going to move to Wyoming, if I wanted to move to Wyoming, I was joking with her. And I said, "Are you going to make chief?" Which is E9, which it's the highest enlisted rank in the Air Force. And she did it as of December.
I never thought I'd make chief. I never thought I'd be here. But there were so many people who did and who believed in me and who pushed me in that direction. Looking back, you know, on the 30 years since I joined, it wasn't a me thing. It was a we thing. You, my chief supporter, but everybody along the way. Thanks for having this conversation with me today.
Yeah, no doubt.
Old man.
Maybe we ought to do this without a facilitator and an appointment.
Right, for sure.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thanks to Melody Edwards, our producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer and social media manager, for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.